Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions, a local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
And from Dartmouth Hitchcock, imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Supreme Court justices like to think of themselves as above politics, but almost on day one of its new term, the court heard arguments on a highly political issue, gerrymandering. The case comes from Wisconsin, where Democrats charged the state assembly map was drawn so dramatically against them that it was unconstitutional. Here's Democratic Congressman Tom Suozzi rallying protesters at the court on the day of oral arguments.
Please continue to try and educate people why partisan gerrymandering is destroying our country and is making it overly partisan. Together, we can make a difference here, but now we need the Supreme Court to help us. Hey, hey, ho, ho, gerrymandering has got to go.
Today on The Exchange, we dig into this case and other key issues before the High Court. One involves digital privacy and law enforcement use of cell phone records. Another concerns the wedding industry, bakers, caterers, florists, and whether religious freedom allows them to refuse services for same-sex marriages. Let's hear from you as we cover these cases. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. With me in studio, John Grabe, professor at UNH Law with an expertise in constitutional law. John's column, Constitutional Connections, appears monthly in the Concord Monitor. And John, welcome back. Good to see you.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us, Jennifer Sargent, associate professor of writing and rhetoric at Dartmouth College. She's a former law professor, district court judge, and public defender. And Jennifer, welcome back. Good to see you too.
Thanks.
Well, both of you, but maybe you first, Jennifer. Before we dive into that whole gerrymandering case, all the predictions seem to point toward a very, I don't know what term to use, important term, significant term. Justice Ginsburg herself predicted it would be momentous. What do you think?
I think she's exactly right. I think it is a momentous term. It's a momentous term, number one, because the Supreme Court has before it some significant constitutional questions that they haven't yet answered, but they've almost been waiting to answer since there's been the vacancy on the court with Justice Scalia's death. They didn't do a whole lot with a lot of significant constitutional questions, some would argue on purpose, while there was a vacancy on the court. Now that Justice Gorsuch is on the court, the Supreme Court has the opportunity to, with a full bench, address a lot of burning questions. And that's what they're going to do this term.
So they're fully staffed. They're ready to go. The Washington Post echoed what you said, Jen. The court was shorthanded for more than a year after the death of Justice Scalia and responded, I'm quoting the Post here, by largely avoiding controversial topics and compromising to reach narrow consensus decisions. So that's the description, John. What do you think?
Well, they did. They found their way out of some very, very significant disputes by finding common ground. And some people wonder whether, having done that for the last year or so, has it maybe awoken some of them to the merits of finding common ground? We'll see. I think most people expect that we'll be back to the, closely divided 5-4 cases in at least some of these cases. But there's no doubt that Chief Justice Roberts would like to see the court find consensus a bit more. And I think he thinks that the court as an institution advances national interests best when it sometimes can find consensus.
Well, we'll have you guys back in June and we'll see how many 5-4s there are. You're right, there might be a lot. Let's turn briefly to that gerrymandering case out of Wisconsin. And John, who are the players and the people involved?
Well, it was a challenge brought to the drawing of legislative districts in the state following the 2010 census. Every 10 years, there's a census, and following the census, population shifts require the redrawing of district lines. That is committed by the Constitution to the state legislature, unless the state is one of those states that has decided to hand it over to an independent redistricting commission. Some states do it that way, but most states do it at the state legislative level. In Wisconsin, following the 2010 elections, Republicans swept into power.
That was a big Republican wave year in many states, including New Hampshire.
That's right. And so in the districting that was done in Wisconsin, even though in the 2012 election, Republicans did not receive a majority of the vote, Democrats did, they ended up with 60 out of 99 seats in the Wisconsin Senate. And it was a direct consequence of the availability of data, greater partisanship, more people voting predictably along party lines. And it's a pattern that has repeated itself really throughout the country. So a lawsuit was brought challenging the drawing of district lines on partisan grounds to entrench a majority, arguing that that violates the Constitution. And that's an issue that the Supreme Court has taken up a few times but never been able to decide.
Well, with us now on how this issue has played out in New Hampshire is NHPR's News Director Dan Barrick. Last year, Dan and reporter Natasha Haverty analyzed possible gerrymandering in how our state's Senate districts are drawn. There's a link to that work, by the way, on our website. Lots of maps and information. NHPR.org/exchange. And Dan, thanks a lot for helping us out. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Laura.
So when people think about gerrymandering, Dan, they might first think of Congress. Why did you guys decide to look at the state Senate?
Well, for a few reasons. Congressional seats don't really make sense for New Hampshire since we only have two. So there's only so many ways you can cut the state into two. But we were really interested in the longer trend that as in the last 15 years or so, as New Hampshire has become more and more of a swing state in presidential elections, the presidential vote statewide is usually quite narrow. We've been increasingly seeing Democrats being elected to statewide office governor. We've got two Democratic senators, two Democratic congresswomen. But we're interested in why the state house was the one Republican bulwark, which, with a couple of exceptions, why Republicans were so successful in maintaining leadership control of the state house. And we looked at the state Senate for the one reason was because with only 24 seats, the amount of numbers that you had to crunch was considerably easier than the 400-member legislature. So we focused on the state Senate and looked at the pattern of redistricting going back really to the 80s, but with a particular focus over the last two redistricting rounds after the 2000 and 2010 censuses.
So you guys looked at New Hampshire's political trends, seeing that New Hampshire was picking, at the federal level, Democratic members of Congress frequently, and now we have an all-Democratic delegation, in presidential races, frequently picking Democrats, and yet at the State House, more in Republican hands.
Really,
so you said, let's look at that.
What we've seen, the only times in the last 15 years when Democrats have been able to win control of the State House was in these extreme wave elections in 2006 and 2008. So that's why we focused on the State Senate.
So, Dan, explain in layperson terms, if you can, the analytical approach that you took, because this came up in the Wisconsin case as well before the U.S. Supreme Court. Words like pack and crack are coming up. So what does that mean?
Right. Yeah, we actually, when we were doing this work about a year and a half ago, it was before this case had been accepted by the Supreme Court and before there were really a lot of analytical tools out there in the mainstream. So we actually relied on some of the analysis that Nick Stephanopoulos, one of the lawyers in the Wisconsin case, used. So, right, this term crack and pack is essentially what opponents or critics of gerrymandering say those who do gerrymander use. So they'll either pack their opponents' voters into a couple of safe districts that they will always cede, and then crack or spread the rest of their opponents' supporters into a handful of, basically spread them out so that they'll never be able to win those other districts. And to sort of analyze this, Stephanopoulos and his colleagues developed this thing, what they call the efficiency gap, which sounds really complicated, but it's actually quite an easy analytical tool. It's based on this notion of what they call a wasted vote. So a wasted vote is any vote that if I'm a winning candidate and I'm in a two-person race, I only need 50% plus one vote. Any vote over that 50% plus one is a wasted vote because I didn't need it. I just needed to get right over the midway. Alternatively, any vote for a losing candidate is a wasted vote because it didn't get you what you wanted. So they take all the wasted votes for each party, divide that by the total number of votes, and it gives you one single number, what they call the efficiency gap. And in their mind, any efficiency gap around 7, 8, 9% is indication of an unfair partisan advantage, aka gerrymandering.
Couldn't it just be, Dan, the fact that a lot of Republicans happen to live in that area, or a lot of Democrats happen to live in that area?
Sure, geography, and especially now the way that increasingly you see the party sort of partisan geography that Democrats are increasingly concentrated in urban areas has a lot to do with that. But by their analysis, you could, you know, and when we played it out in New Hampshire, where, you know, we do have some urban areas, but the state is relative. You can find members of each party across the state. But, you know, it's generally accepted that this is sort of the best analytical tool if you want to bring some kind of analysis to this matter.
So tell us again, Dan, what time period you looked at and what changes did you find in these state Senate districts? Again,
well,
24 of them.
Yeah, we focused mostly just over the last 20 years. So that's about 10 elections at the state level. And what we found is that with very few exceptions, there is a pretty much an undeniable Republican advantage in electoral outcomes in the state Senate. And that sort of remains steady over those 20 years, as I said, with the exception of those two sort of Democratic wave years, and particularly since the most recent round of redistricting after the 2010 census, as John mentioned. So, for instance, you know, if you look at what, you know, we'd add up all the vote tallies for all 24 state Senate seats, say in 2012, the Democratic candidates won 52% of the votes. So folks who went out to vote in the 2012 election for a New Hampshire state Senate candidate, 52% of them voted for the Democrat, 48% for the Republicans. Republicans still managed to come away with a 13-11 advantage in the state Senate. They still had a two-seat majority, despite the fact that Democrats won considerably more votes total. 2 years later, Republicans won 52% of the total vote, but even increased their advantage in the state Senate. And last year, the most recent election, it was pretty much a 50-50 split. Democratic candidates for state Senate won almost as many votes as Republicans, and Republicans came away with a 4-seat advantage of the state Senate. So, and you're right, part of that is geographic spread. Part of that has to do with if there's uncontested races. We accounted for all of that in our analysis, following the suggestions and advice of the folks who developed this. But since 2002, we came up with about an 8% partisan advantage, pro-Republican partisan advantage, meaning since 2002, the legislative map that now holds for the New Hampshire State Senate gives Republicans about an 8% advantage, 8% more seats than they would have picked up with a nonpartisan, purely random map of the state.
And we could say, Dan, that if Democrats had been in charge in 2010, they probably would have drawn the districts in their favor, too. I mean, everybody does this.
A lot of Democrats say that. I mean, we went in our reporting, we talked to Democrats in New Hampshire who say we would have done the same thing if we'd held the majority. So that's why, as John indicated, a handful of states have turned it over to an independent commission. There's been several efforts over the last few years in New Hampshire to do that. All of them have failed, and almost universally along party lines, with Democrats supporting them and Republicans opposing it. So it looks like at least, you know, for the next, I would wager at least through the next census, the 2020 census, and then the subsequent redistricting that will happen there, that will have the same system, that the party in power, i.e. whichever party wins control of the legislature in the 2020 elections, will be holding the pen when it comes time to redraw the map.
All right. Well, and again, we've got an analysis of that online. You can see Dan's work at our website, nhpr.org/exchange, on gerrymandering in New Hampshire's state Senate. Dan, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Laura.
That's NHPR's news director, Dan Barrick. So John Graby and Jennifer Sargent, pack and crack came up, as Dan told us, when this U.S. Supreme Court case was heard. The efficiency gap that Dan mentioned was also part of the conversation at the U.S. Supreme Court. And Chief Justice John Roberts called this efficiency gap concept, quoting here, sociological gobbledygook. So you heard some hesitancy by the justices to wade into this issue.
Yeah. And the sociologists and social scientists and quantitative social scientists weren't too happy with that comment. One of them even went so far as to
say
they
didn't like their work called gobbledygook.
No. And they also invited the Chief Justice and his colleagues to come and have a sit down so that they could give them a little lesson on how exactly to do the math. And it's interesting because there was also this October 19th article in The Washington Post, and it was entitled, "Is the Supreme Court Allergic to Math?" by David Post, from October 19th. And the article suggests that the Supreme Court has, on more than one occasion, said, you know, we just don't know how to do math, and we don't really think that it's our province to be doing the math. We're constitutional scholars, kind of like the reason I didn't go to law school, the reason I didn't go to medical school, I went to law school, is because I can't do math. But in this case, the lower court in Gill versus Whitford actually used several different mathematical principles to suggest that gerrymandering districts can be identified and drawn fairly. They can be identified as unfair. And it isn't just the efficiency gap that it made reference to. It made reference to the median index, a partisan bias measure, other mathematical measures as well. So the court's going to have to get into two issues in Gill versus Whitford, really. And the first issue is the most salient issue, I think, and that is, should the court be involved at all in this partisan gerrymandering issue, period, end?
And they seem, some of them seemed quite hesitant to do so.
Yes, absolutely. Not only are some of them hesitant to do so, but precedent to many of them suggests that they're not supposed to be involved in this, going back to the 60s, as far back as Baker versus Carr. So that's going to be a persuasive argument for some of them. And then others of the justices, even if they believe the courts can be involved, are really going to have trouble sussing out the gobbledygook, as they say, you know, making sure that they know how to do the mathematical strategy and understand how they're going to draw, if they're going to make a standard for what is partisan gerrymandering, how do they draw the standard with a mathematical formula? And many of them, I think, are not confident that they'll know how to do that.
The number for you to join us with your questions and comments on this gerrymandering case that we're talking about right now is 1-800-892-6477. You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. A little bit later, we'll turn to a couple of other cases, including one concerning religious freedom, another digital privacy. But right now, we're talking about this U.S. Supreme Court case concerning gerrymandering out of Wisconsin. So, John, what are the constitutional principles at stake?
Well, the threshold issue is whether or not this is a matter under the Constitution for the judiciary. As Jen just said, there's a doctrine known as the political question doctrine that holds that certain types of disputes are completely committed to the coordinate branches of the federal government, and that even when you have a plaintiff withstanding saying that the Constitution has been violated, the court should not get involved. Sometimes the reason given is that textually the Constitution says this is solely to be decided by either the president or Congress. Sometimes the problem is that the judiciary can't come up with a manageable standard, a test for figuring out where the constitutional line is. In this case, the focus has really been on the latter of those two problems, coming up with a manageable standard. This issue of gerrymandering has been to the Supreme Court twice before, once in 1986 and once in 2005. And in 1986, a slim majority of the court did indicate that these cases are justiciable. And by justiciable, that means can be decided by a court. But they were unable to agree on a standard to be applied. In 2005, the court was split 4-4-1. Four justices said we shouldn't even be able to decide these cases. Excuse me. Four justices said we can, and Justice Kennedy was in the middle. So I think everybody is watching Justice Kennedy. But I think beyond that, there is going to be a problem because the justices who would like to adjudicate these claims have never been able to agree on a common standard for doing so.
All right. Coming up, I've got one more question on this for both of you, and then we will turn to this question. What's the difference between religious freedom and discrimination? That's what the court is going to have to decide in the case of a wedding cake baker and a same-sex couple in Colorado. So we'll tackle that as well. The number 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. We'll be right back.
Hey, Virginia Prescott.
Hey, Nick Capodice.
Give me the first U.S. president born in a hospital.
James Buchanan.
James Buchanan?
That's light.
Wasn't he our singlest president?
It's Jimmy Carter.
Seriously?
Seriously.
Mom. If you want to top that, come to NHBR's first ever Civics 101 Bar Trivia Night at True Brew Barista in Concord on Wednesday, October 25th at 7.
Virginia and I are hosting it. It'll be so fun. More info at nhpr.org.
So come on. You couldn't sound any stupider than I just did.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in Exchange, a new term at the U.S. Supreme Court has begun. Major cases include the drawing of political boundaries and a practice called gerrymandering. Also, digital privacy and cell phone records has come up, and the issue of religious freedom. And we'll tackle that in just a moment. But one more question for both of you, Jennifer Sargent and John Grabe, on this gerrymandering case out of Wisconsin. And both of you talked earlier about how some of the justices are not really sure they even want to jump in on this. If they decide to rule on this and you know, decide whether this Wisconsin drawing of the map was legit or not, Jen, what are the repercussions? Let's say the court rules in favor of the plaintiffs, the Wisconsin Democrats who feel the lines were drawn so heavily against them that they could never win. What happens in other states?
Well, other states are going to be bound by the rule that the Supreme Court comes up with. So there could be the redistricting commissions have to follow the formula that the Supreme Court has enumerated to the best of its ability. It may be a lot of guidance. It may be very little guidance. We don't exactly know. But the redistricting commissions are going to be required now constitutionally to make sure, I believe, if the court wades into it, that there's at least this one person, one vote requirement of the Constitution that they're going to have to make sure they uphold.
And what if the court rules in favor of the Republicans in Wisconsin and says, yeah, you know, the Constitution says the party in charge has the right to draw the lines, so go ahead.
Well, then things will just continue as they are, and the 2020 election will be huge because
the census, victor goes the spoils.
Yeah, exactly. The census happens again in 2020, and whoever wins in 2020 is going to have political power and is going to be in charge of drawing legislative districts around the country.
You know what I understand, John, and maybe you can explain this to me. We talked a lot in our first segment about how the court was, you know, unsure about the math and was hesitant whether this was even really their jurisdiction. Why do they even take this case then?
Well, because
they reject a lot of cases. They say, nah, we're not going to do that.
Well, but the lower court actually found that there had been unconstitutional behavior by the Wisconsin legislature in drawing these legislative districts. And so leaving that precedent to stand would wreak havoc. Moreover, this is one of the rare contexts where the court actually has to take cases. In election law contexts such as this, the way in which this is adjudicated is the case immediately goes to a three-judge district court, which functions both as a trial court and as the appeals court. And there are provisions in the law for review in the Supreme Court in most instances. So the Supreme Court really had to take this case up.
That's interesting, because often they have wide latitude to accept or reject, and that in and of itself is, you know, upsetting to people who try to bring these cases. But in this instance, they had to take it.
Well, pretty much, yeah. There's a little bit of wiggle room, but basically they have to take cases, especially determinations on the merits that there's been unconstitutional behavior below.
Well, let's turn to another case that has been branded a religious freedom case. And this is the question, Jen, that has come up a lot: when one person's exercise of that freedom feels like discrimination to someone else. This is a case out of Colorado, as I said. Who are the key actors in this drama, Jen?
Well, the key actors in this drama are two men named Charlie Craig and David Mullins, and they are a same-sex couple who requested that the Masterpiece Cake Shop in Lakewood, Colorado, make their wedding cake. And the owner of the Masterpiece Cake Shop, his name is Jack Phillips. He objected to making a wedding cake for their same-sex wedding. He said that he believed that decorating cakes is a form of art through which he can honor God, and it would displease God to create cakes for same-sex marriages. Now, his business, the business of the Masterpiece Cake Shop, along with other businesses, are governed by this Colorado Anti-Discrimination Act, the CADA, which is a viewpoint-neutral, content-neutral act that requires businesses to accommodate without discrimination. It's an anti-discrimination and accommodation law. So what Mr. Craig and Mr. Mullins are saying is that the free speech clause and the free exercise clause don't allow a defense to a claim. They don't provide defenses to the claim that that one can engage in discriminatory conduct when there is already in place a content and neutral and viewpoint neutral state law which prevents the discrimination. And the owner of the Masterpiece Cake Shop is saying, wait a minute, I actually have both a free speech and a free exercise right.
Free exercise means free exercise
of
religion.
Right. To say that even though there is the Colorado Public Accommodations Law, I have the right to say that designing and making a cake is something that I get to call because I think it violates my sincerely held religious beliefs about same-sex marriage.
Well, and by the way, on our website, nhpr.org/exchange, we have put up a nice video that the New York Times did, brief interviews with both of the parties in this case, and it's interesting to hear it straight from the people affected. So check that out at our website, nhpr.org/exchange. John, I'd love your thoughts on this, too. We've talked a lot about the First Amendment before. There's a lot packed into that one little amendment, and sometimes these values are clashing.
That's right. This is not a new issue for the Supreme Court. The question of whether or not people on the basis of religious objections can excuse themselves from compliance with the law. There was a very high profile case in the 1990s where two members of the Native American Church lost their jobs because they used peyote. And they claimed that they had to do so. That was central to their religious practice. There was a law that said if you lose your job because of unlawful drug use, you can't collect unemployment benefits. They brought a challenge saying that the application of that law to them violated their First Amendment rights. And in an opinion written by Justice Scalia, the court said no. Your religious beliefs do not excuse you from compliance with a generally applicable law. So if that precedent is followed here, the court would simply say, sorry, you are a business. You are a place of public accommodation. You have to comply with the law. One of the laws that governs businesses and places of public accommodation is that people cannot be turned away for discriminatory reasons, including sexual orientation. End of case. Now, at the time that earlier peyote case I just described was decided, it was very, very heavily criticized. And there are some older precedents that point in the other direction. And so the court once again finds itself at a crossroads where it's trying to balance, on the one hand, this promise of that people can freely exercise their religion. And as Jen said, there's also a free speech component to the case. But on the other hand, the anti-discrimination principle that's baked into the Equal Protection Clause and now written into the statutes of many, many states around the country.
Baked into, no pun intended.
Yes, exactly.
We're talking about wedding cakes here. Well, and I remember hearing about the peyote case. Wasn't there another case? One of you, correct me if I'm wrong. Someone was a Quaker opposed to war, or theoretically, if someone was a Quaker and opposed to war, could they withhold, you know, their taxes dedicated to American war fighting efforts and call that religious freedom? I don't know if this has come up before or if it's just a theoretical.
There are, and there was a case where the Amish did not want to send their children to school until they were 16, and in that case, an accommodation was made. So again, and this is unfortunately the case in the context of the First Amendment. There's case law pointing in both directions. And so, it brings us to the point of these controversies where the court has to decide how to balance competing constitutional values.
Again, the number for you to join us with your questions and comments is 1-800-892-6477. We're looking at the new term that just began at the U.S. Supreme Court, beginning with some old, longstanding debates. We talked earlier about gerrymandering and that case out of Wisconsin, which could have repercussions nationwide. Now we're looking at a religious freedom cake, the case of a wedding cake baker who did not want to make a cake for a same-sex couple in Colorado. Again, the number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. So both of you, Jen, you first. Sometimes the court rules big with repercussions for everybody. And sometimes, more and more, it seems lately, it rules narrow with decisions that just apply to the specific instance and the specific people involved in that particular case. Which way do you think it'll go this time? Wide or narrow, Jen? What do you think?
I think Well, I'm gonna go on how the Supreme Court really likes to decide their cases, and that's narrow.
Yeah.
Whenever they have the opportunity to decide their case narrowly, they're going to do that. What's different about this case is it provides two outlets, both of which the Supreme Court can choose one of. You know, it can go primarily free speech, or it can go primarily free exercise clause. It can't avoid the religion topic entirely because it's a question of religious beliefs. But at the same time, the Supreme Court could say, we're going to analyze this really purely from a free speech analysis and ignore the free exercise claim to the extent that we can. Or it may decide that it wants to engage in a discussion of both for whatever reason. You know, the court doesn't really like to bind itself for future cases. The one thing that the court does have to work with, however, is the Obergefell case, which is the same-sex marriage case. And a lot of people are talking about how this case is sort of the natural outgrowth of the Obergefell case, not only for, you know, this benefit, but for all benefits that come to those who are the product of same-sex union, that they should have all of the trappings and privileges that go with the institution of marriage. So the court is going to have to reconcile somehow Obergefell, I believe, with the Masterpiece Cake Shop, and at least go broad enough to know that Obergefell insinuates that there are other things besides cakes that the court is going to have to deal with in the future.
Well, and I'm glad you mentioned the Obergefell case, the big, big case, making same-sex marriage the law of the land. So if that's where we're at now, John Grabe, and the court itself has said yes, how much wiggle room do individuals like this cake maker really have?
Well, in Obergefell, and Justice Kennedy was the author of Obergefell, and he was actually the author of all of the major decisions recognizing the rights of same-sex couples, he was at pains to say that we're not deciding in this case that this means that, you know, that those of religious belief are going to have to, you know, see their religious beliefs give way. So this is, you know, he did textually leave in the opinion room to draw a different line. And you know, at bottom, this isn't a claim of discrimination under the Constitution. This is a claim of discrimination under state law. And one of the other things that was left open in the Obergefell decision was really, what is the status of discrimination based on sexual orientation? Yes, they did recognize a right to same-sex marriage. But the doctrinal basis for recognizing that right was really left pretty unclear. And I don't think it's fair to say that the Supreme Court has decided that discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation under the Constitution is to be treated the same way as, for example, discrimination on the basis of race. It's still muddled. And I would say all eyes will be and should be on Justice Kennedy, because I think he's likely to be the driving the driver of this decision.
And whether they decide to, as we discussed earlier, go big or go small.
Yeah.
Again, the number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. The number, 1-800-892-6477. So that's a big one. I want to turn to two other big, big cases that we will be watching this year and that will definitely cover with you folks once they're decided. One has to do with President Trump's travel ban. And John, I wanted to go to you first on that. This is very confusing. The ban is on. No, it's not. It's off. It's on. There's five countries. No, there's seven. It's extremely confusing. Where does this stand in the legal sense right now, please?
Okay. Well, we recently had the president release his third version of the travel ban. So you'll see news coverage of it referring to it as Travel Ban 3.0. And this third version of the travel ban has been temporarily enjoined from going into effect, which means that judges have taken a look at it and said not that it is unconstitutional, but they think that it's likely unconstitutional.
So it's on hold.
It's on hold.
Travel ban 3.0, and I actually appreciate that description because there's been a lot of iterations.
Yes, yeah. A judge in Hawaii and a judge in Maryland. So two federal district court judges have looked at it and said we think it's likely unconstitutional for slightly different reasons. Now, you may recall that the Supreme Court actually took the case of Travel Ban 2.0.
Right.
Now, because that's been superseded, the court has dismissed. They were going to hold oral arguments earlier this month. They've decided not to hold oral arguments. I think they've dismissed one of the two cases that they were going to hear oral arguments on. And the other one, I think it's just a matter of time until they do dismiss it. So really, there's nothing there. You know, there's still one of the two cases is technically pending at the Supreme Court, but I don't think the Supreme Court's going to act on one of the old travel bans because it's been replaced. It's expired and it's been replaced. This new travel ban ruling will likely travel a similar route up to the Supreme Court. So these two district judges have decided preliminarily, we think this is unconstitutional. Now the appeals courts within these jurisdictions, so the Ninth Circuit and the Fourth Circuit, will likely review these decisions. And then the Supreme Court will have the ability to take these cases if it wants. And it took the earlier case, so I think it's likely that the Supreme Court will take these cases as well.
I see. So I thought that the court had to decide at the beginning of the new term, these are all the ones we're going to take. And once they decided that, nothing new could come in. But they could take this, Jen, you know, at any time.
Absolutely. Yeah. They take a lot of cases during the term, not all to be argued within the same term that they take them. But they can take a case whenever they want to and put it on for argument if they see fit.
What's the best way for average people like me who don't have legal backgrounds to understand, Jen, I don't know if you want to jump in on this, to understand just the process that this travel ban has taken through the courts? You know, never mind, you know, you guys are legal analysts, not political analysts, so we won't get into the politics of it, but it's very difficult, Jen, to understand, you know, travel ban 1.0, 2.0, 3.0, appeals courts, Supreme Court, and so on.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that one of the best ways to learn about the process is, first of all, obviously, to go to the internet and look at what some of the major trustworthy news outlets are putting out about the process. But I also think that the whitehouse.gov website is really informative. At the whitehouse.gov website, for instance, the press office, if you go to the briefing room, there's a place on the website that's called Statements and Releases. And they actually have a fact sheet called Fact Sheet, Proclamation on Enhancing Vetting Capabilities and Processes for Detecting Attempted Entry into the United States by Terrorists, basically saying, here's Travel Ban 3.0, and here are the highlights. Here's a highlight reel of what it actually says. And it has bullet points and breaks the whole thing down. And if you go to the whitehouse.gov site, you can look at the old travel ban and the new travel ban. You can put them side by side, see what the differences are, see how they're drawn differently, look at how the White House has described them differently. There are FAQ sites on the whitehouse.gov site, which are sort of the frequently asked questions about what's the difference between the two travel bans. So the White House itself is trying to give a lot of guidance, but you have to understand when you're looking at the White House's site, you're seeing what the White House wants to put out in the factual way that the White House wants you to view it. So factually, it's very useful, but in terms of interpretation, you want to look at a lot of different sources.
Well, we've got some resources on our website as well, nhpr.org/exchange, including figuring out the role of all these lower courts and how this keeps going around and around in our judicial system. So we'll set that aside for the moment. Again, you can check out our website, nhpr.org/exchange. Coming up, do we have an expectation of digital privacy? We will tackle that in just a moment, and we'll take your emails and comments. Your calls are welcome, too, at 1-800-892-6477. The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at the U.S. Supreme Court's new term that just opened at the beginning of October. Major issues for this legal season include the drawing of political boundaries, or a practice called gerrymandering. Also, the issue of religious freedom and whether those who object to same-sex marriage should have to provide services for same-sex couples, such as cake baking. That's a case out of Colorado. We're also going to cover in just a moment a case concerning digital privacy and how much expectation we should have of that with smartphones and so forth. We'd love to hear from you, 1-800-892-6477. Your questions about some of the legal issues at stake in these cases, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. And John Graby, Jennifer Sargent, let's go to our listeners. And Peggy's in Center Harbor. Hi, Peggy. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. Referring to the case of the religious freedom and same-sex marriage, I saw a bumper sticker the other day that to me says it all, and I'm going to leave that as my comment. The bumper sticker said, "The last time we mixed politics with religion, people were burned at the stake."
So not, yeah, not feeling like this is a uncomfortable mix of politics and religion. And boy, she's going way back to the Salem witch trials there, John Graby. And, you know, in a way, we have been debating this for a long, long time in our Constitution.
We have. And, you know, when the Civil Rights Act was passed in 1964, that was a federal statute that that first mandated non-discrimination in places of public accommodation around the country. These same arguments were actually made, at least in certain parts of the country, with respect to race. Many people claim that their religious beliefs required them to turn away people of a different race, or that the mixing of the races was counter to their religious beliefs. So really, there's nothing new under the sun. This case raises really, really complex issues, and whichever way it's decided, we refer to the slippery slope, right, in law, that if you decide something X over here, logically it implies Y and Z. Deciding this matter in such a way as to recognize a constitutional right to exempt oneself from the law is really, really complicated, particularly if it's grounded in religious belief and not the First Amendment, because the government can't inquire into one's religious belief and say, that's not something that you can believe, or that's not something that we think you sincerely believe. It's a really, really tricky issue.
Well, and it gets to what you said earlier, too, Jen, makes me think that the Supreme Court, you said they like to go small, go narrow, not sometimes resolve these ginormous questions. So in this instance, it really makes you wonder which way they're going to go.
Yeah, it makes you wonder.
All right, let's take another call. This is Kevin in Bedford. Hi, Kevin. Thanks for joining us today. Go ahead.
Well, thanks for having me. A longtime listener. Love your show. I love your panel. You guys bring up some great points. But I wanted to look at from the other side of the room. Isn't it discriminatory to the baker that, you know, all of a sudden the Supreme Court's going to force him to do something that he doesn't believe in, not only from a religious point of view, but from an artistic point of view, right? He's saying that, you know, his art is pleasing to the Lord. And think about if a contractor, you know, he could go up and do a bid and just make his bid so high and not call out that, oh, it's because you're same-sex marriage. In this case, the cake, pretty obvious. But
I see.
I hope the Supreme Court isn't narrow, because it's bigger than just being discriminated against same sex. I mean, he has a right to practice his religion, and he has a right to practice his business practices also.
You know, Kevin, it's an interesting point, too. You know, the baker could have just said, yeah, I can make your cake, but it'll be, you know, $50,000 or something. I'm not sure what's outrageous for a wedding cake. But instead, he chose to say what he honestly felt. And Jen, I'd love your thoughts. Kevin saying, look, there's another side to this.
As much as there may be that other side to it, I think what the crux of the case is the fact that it revolves around a state law that is content and viewpoint neutral. And it is an anti-discrimination statute that really is there to provide non-discriminatory accommodations for everybody. And the court gets into what John said, that slippery slope, when it starts to decide whether or not anything gets exempted from that neutral content statute.
So, and just to help us understand, this case really then is about not so much, you know, the Supreme Court's ruling making same-sex marriage legal, and allowable in all 50 states. This is about Colorado's anti-discrimination law and whether this particular baker violated Colorado's law.
And that's, I think, where this, where the court may go is just to that law and not go bigger than that.
Because they want to go narrow.
And also, they just set themselves up for a whole host of other issues, and they like to decide them as they come in. They don't like to decide anything in a peremptory kind of way.
Well, Kevin, I appreciate the call. And here's an email from Matt. This is on our earlier conversation on the travel ban, John, so I'm going to throw this on you. Matt says, if judges can rule on law based on interpretation of a person's speech and not the text of a law or a presidential decree, then where does it end? Matt says, the text is what is being given the force of law, not arbitrary statements made on podiums or talk shows. I think what Matt's getting at, John, is that President Trump's tweets, prior statements on the campaign trail are being taken into account when it comes to deciding this as a legal matter.
Yeah, it's a fascinating aspect of this case. You know, laws and executive orders and regulations that on their face are neutral. Now, the first two travel bans did not on their face discriminate against Muslims, but the lower court decisions looked to the president's campaign statements. They looked to his tweets and held that there was a likelihood that they were actually based on anti-Muslim sentiment. That's really an extraordinary ruling. I mean, Matt is right. You know, when courts review the work of a coordinate branch of government, they typically do not go beyond the text. And yet, because we recognize that we do have a sorry history of discrimination and of facially neutral laws really being rooted in discriminatory animus, the law does allow, it does make accommodation for proof of that. What's really, really remarkable, though, is for courts to be finding that with respect to the President of the United States and a coordinate branch of the federal government. It's one thing to find that maybe a local zoning board was behaving in a discriminatory way in terms of, you know, granting licenses to build. It's another thing to say that the President of the United States and his office is acting on the basis of malevolent discrimination when the law in question on its face doesn't discriminate.
Well, Matt, thank you for the email. Jen, did you want to jump in on that?
The Hawaii judge who rendered the first injunction now on Travel Ban 3.0 actually stayed away from that question entirely and really stayed very close to the issue of whether or not the president has overstepped his bounds in terms of can Congress be the only body that can regulate the travel and visa process and immigration of the countries, of the people in the countries that are banned from coming in currently. It wasn't until we got to the Maryland judge that the Maryland judge waded a little bit into that intent. And the Muslim ban and the religious aspect of the ban. So now we have a different situation perhaps than we had with Travel Ban 2.0 in that the Hawaii judge's injunction isn't based on Trump's previous statements of any sort.
Well, and here's an email on the cake baker case that we talked about earlier. This is from Jerry in Dover who says, as a very wise public servant recently commented to a legislator who claimed something was violating her religious beliefs, quote, you put your hand on the Bible to uphold the Constitution, not the other way around. Jerry, thank you for the email. And I did want to turn to one more case that comes up on a lot of lists of sort of the big cases to watch at the U.S. Supreme Court this year. And that's the question of what expectations of privacy we should have in the digital age. This case is called Carpenter versus the United States. Comes from Detroit, Michigan. So again, Jen, you know, raising the curtain, who are the actors on the stage here?
Well, maybe we should have John talk about this one because he's from Michigan. I'll take it. So here, in April of 2011, the police arrested four men in conjunction with a series of armed robberies. The individual in this case, the defendant, is one of those men. There was a different defendant who confessed to the crimes, and he gave the FBI his cell phone number and the numbers of the other participants in the robberies. The FBI used the information to apply for three orders, not for warrants, but for orders under the Stored Communications Act, which is an act that allows the FBI to ask for certain telephone and telephonic communication information without probable cause, which is the trigger for obtaining a search warrant. So the police, the FBI, were able to get information not only about the numbers that the alleged perpetrators had called, but also their whereabouts, the pinging off of the cell towers, which tells the FBI where the perpetrators, the alleged perpetrators, have been and where their locations have been.
And there was a series of armed robberies. And using these records, right, Jen, law enforcement was able to determine that, you know, Joe suspect was in that exact location every single time.
Right. They think that the pinging information that they got put the perpetrator right there and used that against him. And so this is, and the defendant's name in the case is Timothy Carpenter. And the government charged him with aiding, abetting, and robbery and affecting interstate commerce when he committed those robberies. And he's challenged the ability of the FBI to obtain that type of information about his whereabouts from the telephonic records without a search warrant, without the finding of probable cause to get that search warrant. So this is a dead-on Fourth Amendment search and seizure case.
There's something else at play here, John, that I read about, the eyewitness rule. So how does that sort of apply to this case of whether or not the FBI needed a search warrant to go after those cell tower records?
Well, there's a law professor named Orrin Kerr who I love to follow, and he's actually argued that the eyewitness rule should really dispose of this case. The eyewitness rule is that the government, in investigating a crime, always can go to an eyewitness and say, what did you see? And by analogy here, that's what the government is doing.
That the cell phone company or the tower is an eyewitness,
right,
to this,
I mean, yeah,
person's whereabouts.
It's an inanimate eyewitness, but that you are handing your information over by using a cell phone. You know that you are handing your information over to a cell phone provider. They are going to collect that information. They're going to store that communication. They're going to use that information for various business purposes. And when you hand information over to a third party, the third party can be asked for that information. And the Fourth Amendment doesn't limit the ability of law enforcement to do that.
So the cell phone tower is an eyewitness. Right. It collected the information and it said to the FBI, here you go. I, quote unquote, saw this guy. So should that apply here then?
Well, that's the question. I mean, there are people who are saying that the old precedents really are not well suited for our new digital reality. And the court has taken a step down that road. A few years ago, the court decided that, you know, at the point of arrest, that government agents can't simply look into your cell phone as part of a search incident to arrest, that we use our cell phones for all sorts of purposes, some of which are private, and that it's not reasonable to say that we have given up our privacy simply by virtue of the fact that we're carrying a cell phone around. Now, whether or not the government makes that sort of a distinction, I'm sorry, not the government, but the court makes that sort of a distinction in this case, it'll be interesting to see, you know. There's a long line of authority saying that if you expose information to the public, to third parties, you are giving up your privacy rights.
Well, when you set up your phone, you have to say, yes, I allow. Yes, you can give me, you know, yes, you can track my location and so forth, because otherwise you won't be able to use that handy function of, you know, GPS when you're lost.
Right.
So in a way, Jen, you've already given up that information to, you know, whoever your provider is.
Right. I agree. The two cases that will really be the seminal cases for the for the defendant in this case are Riley versus California, which is the case that John was talking about from 2014, where the Supreme Court said absolutely must have a search warrant to search a cell phone, must have a determination of probable cause that there is something on the cell phone that is incriminating or that is a link in the chain of evidence needed to convict. And there's also this case from 2012 called United States versus Jones. And that was a case where a car was tracked by the FBI or another government agency with a GPS device. And that was determined by the Supreme Court to be a Fourth Amendment search. However, it differs a little bit from what you just said, which is in that case, the GPS locator was put onto the car without the consent of the person driving the car. And here you're talking about cell phones where you have to basically agree that if you're going to use the service, if you're going to be carrying and using the cell phone, you're going to be utilizing the towers. And once you've utilized the towers, you've agreed to have the towers know where you are. So I think the eyewitness rule may actually trump those cases just by virtue of the facts in this matter.
Why does this issue, John, keep coming up of law enforcement and smartphones? I feel like every time the three of us have sat down, there's been some sort of a digital privacy case on the docket. Why is this so hard to settle? Why don't they just figure this out?
Well, you know, I think the American people want it both ways. You know, we want absolute security. We were attacked in horrific fashion in 2001, and the investigation afterwards led people to conclude that if we had been on top of things a little bit more, we may have been able to head that off. So on the one hand, we want law enforcement to be closely monitoring who is coming in and out of the country and what is going on in this country.
And who's conducting armed robberies in Detroit.
That's right. And on the other hand, we also want our privacy. At times, it is difficult to have both. And drawing that balance, I think, is going to continue to be something that the court is going to be asked to weigh in on.
One more question for both of you. Real quickly, we've talked about four very interesting cases. Jen, other cases that you're going to be watching that you think listeners should know about, apart from these big four that we've talked about?
I love the case of Collins versus Virginia, which is going to come up for oral argument this term. It is also a Fourth Amendment search and seizure case. It has to do with a moving vehicle, which is usually subject to no warrant requirement to search. But because this vehicle, the motorcycle, is on the curtilage of a home, there's sort of this, the home is the castle warrant requirement. So we're going to have to see with how the court wrestles with home versus vehicle under the warrant exception.
How about you, John?
I think that the Supreme Court is going to hold as a matter of constitutional law that members of public employee unions do not have to pay anything at all. They can opt out of union membership, and they don't have to support the union. That's an issue that's been before the court in the past. I think it's pretty clear the way that the court's going to rule on that case.
All right. John Grabe, Jennifer Sargent, thank you very much for being here. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.